Accession number 10743, row 2.
Mr. Treadwell, read the turn.
As I say, just at that moment, our Canadian rear gunner called up on the intercom to the pilot and said, "Daff, there's a 110 on our tail." The pilot's reply at that moment, with a burning engine and himself attempting to dive the aircraft, was very succinct. He said, "I've got my own troubles, shoot the so-and-so down." And that was that. Fortunately for us, the plane evidently thought we were already a goner and sheered off, so we didn't even open fire. But we had to go through, as a novice crew, all the correct procedure. The one thing you couldn't afford to have was a dead prop idling, even if you managed to put the flames out, because this would have doubled the problems on that same side. No engine, and yet have a drag. So there was a correct procedure in which to feather the prop, press the Gravener switches to get the fire extinguishers going, and to dive, as many people did, to try and help put out the flames. The combination of all these did succeed, and the flames went out, and we were probably down to about 17,000 feet. We had dropped our bombs, so we then set off for the coast with one engine completely US. But although it took us rather longer because we got a headwind coming back, the rest of the trip was virtually uneventful, except for being fired at by flak fairly closely over the coast itself. So the visit to Essen had a few lessons for us, which we took to heart. Staying straight and level as long as we did is something we never repeated on running up to a target.
Did you then, on this tour of duty with 77 Squadron, did you concentrate on raids on the Ruhr?
Quite a few. Yes, I did about 9 or 10 trips to the Ruhr, because it really was a place that was dreaded to some extent. It's had the euphemistic name among air crews of Happy Valley, in the same way as Berlin had the name of Big City. It was not a kind of target you relished when you saw it go up on the board in the operations room.
But presumably Berlin was just as feared, was it?
We only did one trip on Berlin, and that was quite an eventful one. Later on, yes, but most of the trips on Berlin were done at night, at a period when the opposition was probably in balance. At different times during the war, the night fighter seemed to have the advantage. Other times, they seemed to sort of be the other way around. We lost a lot of aircraft, probably due to flying conditions as much as the actual fighters, although the fighters were the thing that was concerned there. Yes, people got tired of going to Berlin, certainly from what I heard, but I'd finished my first tour before the multiple Berlin raids came on.
What was your trip to Berlin like?
Pretty hectic. We took off from Yorkshire. We discovered soon after takeoff we got a dicky engine on one side. The I think it was a Portinna, the Merlin, the glycol was obviously leaking somewhere, so that we had the usual story of temperatures going up and pressure falling. But it was gradual to begin with, and it wasn't until we got to the Dutch coast that we had a little crew conference to decide whether we should carry on or not with a one bad engine. The decision was reached, the skipper always made the final decision, but he always consulted the other people, that we would, as we were in the first wave, we'd carry on flying as best we could at reduced speed, and that he would throttle the engine back so it was just ticking over, with the idea that if we had an emergency he would open it up and we'd get away possibly. So we flew right across the target to Berlin, which was quite a distance at that time, falling back throughout the stream the whole time. When we got to Berlin, by the way, the attack that night to fool the Germans was that was based on the idea of a turning point which was about, from memory, 20 or 30 miles southeast of Berlin. And then we did a sharp left-hand turn and ran back over Berlin, having given the idea we were going past it. Just as we got to the turning point, the engine blew up. And once again, for the second time, we had ourselves really in trouble with flames everywhere, going everywhere. We managed to put the fire out by dropping considerably, and we were down to 13,000 feet. And we again had a very brief conversation to decide what we should do. We could have taken a chance legitimately by going round the target in our present state and hoping to avoid main trouble and get back that way, or to go through the middle. Well, one of the problems that was that a briefing that day, we'd been told that the Germans had perfected a new form of light flak, something that was really feared, which could go up to 15,000 feet, and to watch out for it that night. We were down to 13,000 feet below the within that range, if that were true. And so there was quite a bit of foreboding as we went right through the middle. I managed to identify what I thought was the target that night from the flares, from the target indicators, and dropped my bombs, and we carried on. The peculiar thing was that as we sailed right through the centre of Berlin, with a whole lot lit up underneath us, planes above were being shot down right and left, and we had no fighter or flak attacks the whole time. We went right through the middle, and we came out the other side somewhere around 11 or 12,000 feet, absolutely unscathed. We flew home, but because of the engine trouble, we were rather slow, and we were almost given up at base. We were over an hour late landing at base, and it was thought we'd gone west, because I think we'd lost about 30 or 40 four-engined aircraft within 20 minutes over Berlin that night. But that was the only trip we ever did to Berlin, and we didn't want to repeat it under quite those same circumstances.
Do you have the date of that raid?
Yes. This, by the way, was the 23rd of August, 1943. As a result of the night's operation and the work that had to be done by both the pilot and the engineer, both were awarded immediate DFMs. I believe that the rest of the crew received some sort of commendation as well. Right.
You said that if the Ruhr went up as the target for that night, that people were a bit down in the mouth about it, but...
I think more apprehensive rather than down the mouth, because there was no visible sign of anything like panic or anything like that at all. People accepted things apparently matter-of-factly, but and even made rather grim jokes about the particular targets, but you never... It wasn't sort of, shall I say, immediately visible, any reaction that way, except to say, oh, blow our so-and-so luck, or something like that, or I've got a date tomorrow, blow my so-and-so luck for being on this one tonight, and so on. I think you were saying about Berlin, yes, I believe Berlin and the Ruhr were probably two of the worst targets that people would rather not go to, let's put it that way.
But presumably people were suppressing their apprehensions. Did it come out in any physical or mental ways?
Yes, it came out in the form of tics, as it were, usually under the eye. You'd get a little pulse beating there. Sometimes it happened and it wasn't visible, but you could feel it. And I must admit, towards the end of that tour, I had a non-visible tick, which under my right eye I could feel, and this we were told was due to the accumulation of tensions one way or the other. As an example of that, we had the wireless operator leader, signals leader, who'd done 30 trips and had volunteered for a 31st, which officially weren't allowed to do at that time. He was the personification of someone who didn't care, who never worried at all. After he was taken off operations, which was shortly after that, they examined him because he'd had trouble with his neck and found all the nerves in his neck were absolutely tied up. His tension apparently had gone to one part of his body, and that was the his way of absorbing the tension that had accumulated elsewhere. It was just in the neck.
Did you have people who actually cracked up under the strain?
I never saw anyone... you know the term LMF, lack of moral fibre. That was feared by a lot of people more than going on ops, perhaps. but
being branded with
LMF, which was a rather disgusting thing, I felt, particularly if people had done a number of operations, their nerves had simply gone, they couldn't take it. As you probably know, they were stripped of all rank, all their documents were endorsed LMF, and they were reduced to the ranks and posted to some of the worst situations, so I understand.
What do you mean by the worst situation?
Well, sort of outlying stations, I believe, anything where the jobs were not considered exactly decent one way or the other. But it was a sort of double disgrace. On the other hand, I don't think fear of LMF, was a major point in people's decision to go on. In most cases, it was felt, as far as I could observe, that it was a job to be done and you did it. Or you did your best to do it.
So, which were the preferred targets if the Ruhr and Berlin were not?
Well, I'm talking about over the period of 3 or 4 years, but obviously French targets, if there were any. We did Milan on one trip, which was considered a very easy trip. The highlight of that was to fly on a brilliant moonlight night within 20 miles of Mont Blanc and see the contrast between the snow tops and the dark caverns down below. The opposition at Milan was nominal, and we felt that the searchlights were probably being operated by the crews, who ran out, spun the thing round and round in circles, then ran back to the shelter because no attempt was made to pick up aircraft. So that was a comparatively uneventful raid, although we did lose a few aircraft, probably about 4 or 5, principally, we believe, because of engine trouble and trying to negotiate over the mountains. Most of them probably crashed on that. We came back on that particular trip to the south of England. Because of the length of the flight, coming down from Yorkshire there, a lot of aircraft were running out of fuel. And as we approached Great Britain, we received instructions to come down on drones in the south, in some cases fighter drones as well, which, frankly, for four-engined aircraft, wasn't exactly the right thing. We were given a drone in the south to land at. We weren't too badly off, but as we were coming over the coast, we could hear other aircraft calling out that they were going up to a reasonable height, bailing out and hoping the aircraft would go into the sea. This happened quite a few times, and we could see crashes and explosions every so often, so we knew some people were really experiencing shortage of fuel. We had a slight adventure before we got down, in that the outer circles of the fighter drones were very close to each other. We got we contacted the drone concerned. We got our permission to land in a certain sequence. But as we came in to land, another aircraft landed just underneath us, and it took all that we could do, my skipper and myself, pushing the throttles forward to lift us off the top of that aircraft and get round again. My skipper called up flying control, and what he didn't tell them about their antecedents wasn't worth knowing. They gave us permission very humbly to come round again. So we came round again and landed uneventfully. The skipper said, you know, I'm going to add to what I said when I go to the flying control tower to report in. He joined us a little later, and he was a little sort of quiet, so we said, what happened? He said, it was only as I was walking into flying control I saw the name of the aerodrome there. We've landed the wrong drone. We've been taking instructions of one drone and ending up the other. So it was our fault completely, or of course because of the closeness of the drones. So we actually landed at Odium.
You mentioned those searchlight operators at Milan. You guessed not doing their job properly.
Yeah.
If I can ask you the same thing about RAF aircrew, was it possible for an aircrew to avoid doing their job properly to save their own skins? Were there any kind of wrinkles that they could indulge in?
No, I never heard of anything like... Well, I'll tell you about a small technique that we evolved, but I wasn't quite sure whether you would... suggesting they might be dodging the column by not even attacking the target. That's a separate matter. And I believe there were cases, very, very few, I'm told, of where people actually flew either up and down the North Sea, for the requisite time, but I think there was only one case where this was ever proved, but this did happen. It's possible that going to a target in the earlier years, a pilot might have gone rather on the outskirts rather than go through the middle, but with the introduction of cameras on every aircraft, bombing aircraft, I think in 42 or 43, it meant you had a pictorial record because the camera, the F-24, was operated from the bomb push, the bomb release, and at a which released a flash and at the appropriate time opened the shutter, so that you got a picture which was not identical where with where your bombs would drop, but was a very good indication of where you'd actually gone, on what heading and everything else you were on. It's possible they're still continued. On some occasions, of course, the TIs, target indicators, were fairly widely distributed, so possibly people would pick off the outer edge in the hope that they wouldn't go through the middle of the worst of flak. As far as the technique I was mentioning a little earlier was concerned, is that we, at about the time we were in 43, I think we were really getting onto the Ruhr, the Germans had brought in these radar-controlled searchlights, and the idea seemed to be that one searchlight was a master searchlight for possibly a dozen non-radar. And it was very disconcerting. We found that these radar searchlights could almost come straight out on you, straight out of the blue, without looking for you. And the idea was that they would do that, and all the other searchlights would come onto you in the form of a tent, and would hold you. Once they'd got you, it was very difficult to get out of that number of searchlights. We discovered that, noticed that on the ground, these blue searchlights, the master ones, appeared to get to move around on the ground first before getting their elevation. And every time I saw this happen, I got the pilot to turn in the opposite direction, and we developed a technique on going up to the target of turning in. The closing speed, obviously, of the aircraft and the searchlight was very much greater, and we only once ever got coned, and that was over Frankfurt. But
what was it like being in a cone?
Very, very disconcerting indeed. Everything was brilliant light. You knew that they were belting flak at you in the searchlights, and it was a heck of a job to try and dive and turn and twist. Particularly in this case, we still had our bomb load on. We knew the strain on the aircraft itself, but we managed to dodge on that occasion. But we were even more wary later on, particularly at Frankfurt.
Now, can we touch on this question of the accuracy of bombing, which obviously concerned you especially as a bomber, because there's been a lot of controversy about it in the books written about the bombing offensive. What are your own opinions about it as someone who actually flew operations?
Well, when we were given the target maps, there was a specific target to aim for. There's no doubt about that. However, we did know that the pattern of bombing was such that it would spread. Spreading back was mostly as a result of a tailback. That was the expression used. That, because as you ran up to a target, so people would bomb a little bit short, looking at the target indicators, and even some of the pathfinders seemed to be falling short as well. And as the bombing raid progressed, so gradually the bombs fell shorter and shorter in a sort of a mat-like arrangement. The photographs, of course, told their story, and after each raid, Bomber Command issued to all intelligence rooms on the stations maps showing the bomb and the actual plots of each aircraft's bombing with its letter and squadron number. The WAFs who did the plotting were superhuman in the way they could plot photographs, because a photograph without a single vestige of ground on it could be plotted very accurately by them, purely from fires. The time and the incidence of new fires they could get, and a comparison with other people's photographs where there was perhaps a tiny identification point, they could map very accurately where a plane had dropped its bombs, despite the fact, as I say, there was no ground visible at all. The aiming points, APs as we used to call them, was a, well, for a lot of us, was a, the aim. Our intention was to get a photograph with the AP on. I was very lucky in the early days particularly of getting quite a few. In some of the bigger raids later on, you didn't have much of a chance because the whole place was absolutely a sea of flames or white light on clouds and things like that. So there was very little point. But earlier on, and I did get a special commendation for the so-called photographs. In this case, the photographs were there.
This is your citation dated...
18th of January 1944.
For DFC.
Relates to the operations on 77 Squadron. Would you like me to read that part?
Yes, please.
With due modesty, Flying Officer Treadwell's task as bomb aimer in this crew has been carried out in a manner worthy of the highest praise. The photographic record, that of course is the photographic record of the target, is one of sustained brilliance, aiming point being secured on several occasions against important targets. The use of these photographs was a very good way of checking on whether people were consistently going off target or going for it. But as I say, there was a certain amount of rivalry among small groups as to who could get the most aiming points. That was particularly, as I say, in the early days when targets could be identified very readily.
What about the bombing aids that you used regularly, like H2S and so on? What did you use?
Well, as part of the navigation team, I did use the H2S. G, I only used unofficially when the navigator allowed me to do a bit of certain amount of navigation when things were a little bit quiet. H2S was a piece of equipment which I liked very much. There was quite a bit of guesswork, as you probably know. H2S gave you a bearing and a direction, but the maps that we were supplied with the special radar maps which were prepared for us showed the outline of the various towns and of course the coastlines that we could expect to see as we went along.
We've got one in front of us, we should say, and the towns are shown as brown blobs.
Yes, roughly the shape. The problem was that of course on the coastline particularly it didn't differentiate between high and low tide, which meant that at low tide the shape of a headland could be completely changed, or bays and so on there, and it didn't help. As far as the shape of the towns were concerned, it didn't really help at all. All that really mattered was this relative size of the town, and what you had to do was to associate the bigger blobs with the smaller ones and try and fix up a pattern as you saw it on the radar screen. You could often get a fix going across the Ruhr with short of the Ruhr perhaps, because the Ruhr was rather confusing, but you could get a fix on other towns 10-15 miles away, and by means of triangulation you could establish pretty exactly where you were. There were occasions when it was very difficult to know which, say, of three towns you'd got. You'd two groups of three towns, either of which, but there you had to rely on the fact that by calculating navigation you should have been nearer one than the other to help solve that particular problem. We did find it a great help, and we didn't realise at the time that the waves that were going out were actually helping the Germans in many cases to detect our aircraft as well. But certainly H2S was a great aid, there's no doubt about that.
And OBO, did you ever use that?
No, OBO was only on Mosquitoes of Pathfinder Force. The OBO system was to have two ground stations in this country, and they would meet over a particular point. The Mosquito flew until he met the intersection, and the actual dropping of the bomb, of the markers, was arranged from this side. The pilot didn't do this, no one on board, it was dropped from here. Of course the system was very accurate indeed, measured in sort of hundreds of yards on the Ruhr. The Mosquitoes were responsible originally for putting down the yellow flares and then finally the yellow markers as the first stage for the backup by the reds and greens dropped by Pathfinder main force.
Are there any other trips that stick out in your mind about which you can give the details?
Yes, a couple in particular. One on Hamburg and one on Peenemünde. Dealing with the last one first, this has been a well-publicized raid. It had many unusual features for us. We were bombing low level. They'd introduced a new technique, a quarter spot fire, for marking a particular position. But I think the raid has been written up pretty well. I think as we went across the Baltic on the way to Peenemünde, the impression was a brilliant moonlight, all the islands standing out, then a fog, mist or fog coming up, and then finding ourselves just short of the target early, and we've been warned not to bomb before time, and as a result, a lot of aircraft did a dogleg to port. The trouble was we were all at a fairly low level, and we were missing each other's aircraft, sometimes by, it seemed, feet, Stirlings, Halifaxes and Lancasters going in. Peenemünde is on the coast, with the coast stretching out towards the north, and what was obviously at one time a continuation of a ridge was a small island. On that island they dropped this red spot for, fire, which was, I believe, a 2,000 pound canister stuffed with cotton wool and phosphorus. That was a very good indication, and as we flew over that we were lined up straight for the Peenemünde itself. We were carrying no incendiaries, which was unusual, because the idea was not to spoil the aim of the people coming behind. We saw a lot of our own aircraft naturally going in, and I dropped ours on what I saw to be the target, and as we came out, that was when this well-publicised sweep of the German fighters coming from Berlin took place. And so we saw a lot of aircraft going down round about us. Our route lay north across the Baltic and then turned short of the Swedish coast. We'd been given alternative crash drones in Sweden if we were really in trouble, so we had those there. But we had had little or no trouble. We had, however, been warned there might be just one or two light flak guns in the area, and we were not surprised when, as we came out of the target area and turned, we heard a terrific banging noise underneath the aircraft, followed by quite a smell of burning. We thought we were on fire. The rear gunner turned his turret on the beam to look along the fuselage and spotted something red which was getting bigger. So he immediately caught up and said, "Skipper, we're on fire amidships." And I had to go back. He asked me to go back to check to see how bad it was. When I got there, first of all, I found that there was no fire, that the little red lights that we carried inside the fuselage with a shutter on the top of them, one had been jolted by this out of position. So as it was turning, so it was getting brighter and brighter red, which looked like a fire, which meant as we'd got no visible fire, why was the smell of burning? I went back to my position to find the camera had burnt out. That still didn't explain the banging we'd had just before, which we thought might have been light flak. However, it wasn't until we got back to base later on that we realised what had happened.